chapter. Oh, it's 9:30, and I'd like to call the Napoleon Community Service District meeting to order for March 6th, the year of 2002, and we will stand and salute the flag, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Have a roll call, please.
Director Potter.
Here.
Director Wirtz.
Here.
Director Blair.
Here.
Director Brown.
Here.
President McGrath.
Here. At this time, we'll have a public comment period. We can discuss anything that's not on the agenda. And you get about 3 minutes to present what you'd like to say. And if you come to the podium and state your name and whether you're in the district, out of the district, and public comments.
I'll lead off. Okay, well, maybe I'll hold my comment.
Okay, well, we got rid of that one. Any other people on a public comment this time? Seeing none, we will start the first administrative item, which is the status of district service capacities. Mr. Jones.
Yeah, Mr. President, at the last board meeting, some of the board members wanted to know what our capacity fees were, our status of water supply for the district, and I went back and in September-October meeting last year, we went through a procedure showing what the district has and where the capabilities are, and I'll just go through it very briefly here. This is one of the exhibits that was presented. This is out of the county planning department, the South County Area Plan, that was updated in May 1999. It shows urban build-out dwellings and projected population someplace around 210. It's indicated that since the district has a higher density than the county, the area outside the district, since the urban plan is much larger than the district itself, the boundaries, I assume 85% of the district would be in the urban area because much of it is in Cal City there. And since we have a multiple family housing where Cal City doesn't, I've increased about 15%. Based on the number of dwelling units, we've come up with about 400. So I rounded up about 5,000 dwelling units when we go to build out. Based on... And based on a 5-year period, around 0.6 acre feet per unit, and if you have 500, comes up about 3,000 acre feet needed. And there's roughly 300 units being here outside the urban area and Black Lake, which is roughly around another 300 extension units, and then 15% account for water. But we're looking around 3,700 acre feet of water needed, and the Black Lake division probably another 400. And 50, someplace around 4,000 acres needed for build-out purposes. And going through the very similar calculation, we have roughly 7 wells online right now, about 3,300 gallons per minute, which includes about 5,300 acre feet of water per year. And assuming that you're not running those things continuously, so about 80% of normal availability, drops it down around 4,000 or 4,000. Based on the previous slide, we need about 3,700 acre feet. We have 4,000. We are excess of roughly 500 acre feet of water. Black Lake Division has 2 wells, 2,000 acre feet a year. We've been assuming the same concept of 1.8% effective or operation, about 900. Build out them need about 450. And so they're presently almost double the capacity of Black Lake. Wastewater Division. The plant now has a 0.9 capacity, present monthly average is about 0.4 MGD. We're currently providing about 1,700 services, so basically we double the amount of services we presently have. which is probably somewhat less than build out or about build out. So it looks like the wastewater plant for the town division is designed for build out capacity. Same thing with the Black Lake, it's designed for 0.2. We're not even using a small portion of it. Their present number of sewer service is about 536. I think Black Lake build out around 600, a little over 650. And so it's quite adequate capacity for the sewer plant at Black Lake. And I just mentioned we have 12 lift stations, and some of them need to be modified. And the boiler indicated we'd probably be modifying the Test Street lift station. We already modified the lift station at the sewer plant to fill out capacity. And based on Title 22, which is the governing aspect of the state of California, and these sections within the code section, there's a number of graphs in there that were kicked off, and based on our well capacity, about 300 gallons a minute in our present four storage tanks. But here again, I use only the effective amount in the standpipe, so 2.2, although we have 3 million gallons of service. Presently, we have around 2,800 services. And Title 22 has this formula, which is Q, is what the production to well need, based on Q sub 0 and Q sub D. Versus D is our present storage, and Q, our present production. And then taking off the charts, you come up with a Q sub 0 and a D sub 0, which basically are these numbers. When you plug it in, based on our current production, to meet the Title 22 requirements, all we need is about 428 gallons per minute, but we actually have over 3,000. So I went out and I said, okay, off the chart again, I went to 4,000 service connections and came up with the Q's and the B's, plugged into this chart, and basically at 4,000 service connections, we need about 3,200 gallons per minute production from our wells. We have 3,300 gallons per minute, so basically we're in a situation right now that we can go to 4,000 services, and then going down here, basically if we have 4,000 services, present services on our account in the town division, around 2,800 reserve capacity. These are the people that have paid for the intent to serve letters, or will serve letters that have not hooked up yet. And the intent to serve letters, people that have not paid any fees or anything else. These availability about 450 services. I went back and of February 25th last year, we used about 56 of those services. Last 5 years, we had an average billing rate of about 3.8%, or roughly 94 units per year. And so basically our reserve capacity would probably take us out another 3 or 4 years. Under the present circumstances, we're planning next fiscal year to have about another 500 gallons per minute production online, and another storage tank built, and then the main transmission line down Test Street completed.
Where is the water coming from?
The Knollwood project has a well drilled already. They're bringing on 250 gallons per minute. The Vons, or the old Hermit project, had dedicated well roughly around 300 gallons a minute. So those two wells will be put online as the projects come forth.
And the district will assume those wells?
That's correct. So with respect to water supply and infrastructure facility, the district's in fairly good shape. We'll probably need, additional, as the district builds out, infill comes in, maybe additional production or additional storage, additional transmission lines to meet the peaking aspects.
Can I ask a very theoretical question? That's all it is. If, and Black Lake, if there's a drought and a moratorium on certain deliveries anticipated, if Black Lake wanted to drill another well to protect itself, is that possible? Maybe not.
When you say a moratorium, what are we talking about? Why?
If the board imposes stage one or whatever moratorium on certain activities, lawn watering, and in anticipation of this, likely wanting to drill another well, only has two now.
Well, if you assume that the board makes findings that there isn't sufficient water or whatever it is, and Black Lake wanted to go ahead and do it, those findings would affect Black Lake, because if you say the groundwater is over basin or there's no water left in the groundwater pump, if you drill a well in that same basin, same bucket, where are you going to get the water? That's the question, because right now we're getting the water from the same bucket. You're drilling the same bucket. Yeah, you say, I can drill, but you can't. So that's a legal question. I think it'd be up to the board and the aspect of whether opposed or something like that. I'd be happy to answer any questions with the calculations or information.
I think there's several areas of the calculation on the part of the county that we need to question and get a little clearer. The general plan, even as amended in 1994, assumes that a certain build-up population based on the Pomo taking state water. And as you know, Napoleon did not take state water, refused state water. So I'm curious whether the EIR from the county that was certified in 1994 is really valid. In other words, we're saying we have enough water for build-out, but we're talking about compensating for a source that we do not have. I think that's one issue that needs to be explored. Secondly, the number of dwellings that the county included in their build-out list does not include an inventory of the antiquated subdivisions. And they have a partial list, which they're not willing to say is complete, of all the antiquated subdivisions that are here in this South County area plan. Now, my gut feeling is that not too many of those are actually inside our district boundaries. But it would affect our calculations for what percentage of the total number of dwellings would be in district as opposed to outside. I think there's going to be more outside the district lines if they include that inventory than what they're showing. And then I can talk to staff later. I am curious how we arrived at the 65% number. I have no reason to doubt it. But whether that was just pretty good gut feeling, which I would trust, or whether we actually came up with some rough draft of numbers or how we did that. And we can talk about that some other time. I do know this, though, if you look in Exhibit A, the Pomo Community Service District projections, that if we add up the 5,000 from the town division and the 600 from the Black Lake division, and if we assume that's 65% of the total, we still don't come up with the county's number of 7,678 buildings.
Now, Black Lake's not included in that number. It's just the town division. The urban service line, which does not include Black Lake.
Okay, then if we're only looking at 5,000, and saying that that's 65% of the total area, then we're far below 7,678. So our numbers somehow don't fit together here.
Right. And that's why I went in and indicated that there's roughly 300 units outside this urban service line that the county has in their planning numbers, and also adding Black Lake into the former too. And so I'm looking at what we serve, which is in the urban service line and outside the service line, and part of the in-service line is served by Cal Cities, and I discounted that.
Well, I trust that number in terms of knowing how many people we serve and how many are in the pipeline, because those people are paid fees or are being billed. What I'm not sure about is those other numbers that are out there that we keep using as targets, and I don't feel any confidence in those.
Well, in the aspect of going with these numbers here, once the other production comes in and additional storage comes in, we'll probably go up to 7,000 or 8,000 services we could provide. So we're very conservative in that aspect.
No, I think we are conservative. And furthermore, I'm convinced that we do have water for build-out. I'm not questioning the conclusions. But what I'm saying is that what the county's number for build-out and a realistic number for build-out are probably two different things.
Well, yeah. Whatever the county comes up with, since they are in the land use authority, we'll have to have the desire to meet those requirements.
Yes.
You know, it's a very important factor that it isn't addressed and it should be in this analysis. And that's to say to you, there's certain assumptions here.
That's correct. This assumption is there's no restriction for present time of pumping from the basin, and that assumption is cracked into here. If the basin is restricted, then supplemental water supply has to be acquired to make up whatever difference it is.
Very important.
Yeah, and until that decision is made.
Are you finished, Mike? Judy?
Well, I'm just bothered with capacity and productions without sound supply, so I. That was my. It's hard to. When we don't have a guarantee for supplemental water, it's hard to. For me to put in my mind how we can have production and capacity without the supply. That was my comment.
Okay.
Cool, Bob.
You know what bothers me is the focus is on the district. The press focuses on the district. But what they don't understand is Cal Cities and that other rural water company and those people are out there. And if they say, gee, the district doesn't have the water, Cal Cities doesn't look at it that way. And if we deny somebody, they just hook them up. So if we put a moratorium on it, it's not going to come to a grinding halt. Because the other two water companies are going to pick up the slack. So I think the whole thing has to be addressed, not just focus on the district. It seems that the district is in pretty good shape. These other two entities, maybe they ought to look and see if they have capacity to build out or if they what they have. You need a total inventory of everything before you say, well, we're going to put a moratorium on this. You can't put a moratorium on one end. It's like having a bucket. You can't put a hole in one end of the bucket and expect, you know, the water to stay in there and not look at the other end of the bucket.
You know, that's a good point that Director Blair brought up, is that we're not the only game in town. If you shut off the district, Cal Cities are pursued probably very aggressively by service to others. That has happened before when the district put on a moratorium. There's an area just outside the district boundary. They came to the district wishing services. They wouldn't get it, and so they went to Cal Cities. Cal Cities, happy to find them there, now being served by Cal Cities where it should have been served by the district. It's in the district's urban service area, designed by the planning department, within our boundary, in our urban service area, designated within the sphere of influence. And the board had a moratorium because the well was down until a new well got drilled, and the developer did not wish to wait, so we went to Cal City and provided service within our urban service line and within our sphere of influence.
One final comment. In 1972 or 3, before I knew anything about the Pomo Community Service District, I lived on Orchard Road, which was served by Cal Cities. I did a lot line, or a lot split, across the road. And that was during the moratorium. And the district told me I couldn't have water. So I went to Cal Cities and I said, I need water. So they ran the water line underneath the street. And I'm one of the people who put Cal Cities water in the district. Because if you need water, you don't really, as a developer, you don't care where it's coming from. I, at the time, didn't care where it was coming from. And I took the water, and that's exactly what's going to happen. I mean, you think, well, we're just going to shut NCSD down, and it's all going to come to a halt. It is not going to come to a halt. It's going to come from Cal City.
I have a question.
Yes, thank you. All of the pumpers be dictated by the litigation that's going to be the outcome of that, so they just won't take, it'll affect all purveyors and people who own wells. Isn't that the purpose of all? It's just not going to target
the outcome of the litigation. It'll probably be a water master and a managed basin, depending on how it's settled. But I think what's being discussed here is the district putting a moratorium on prior to that decision being made. And if the district just goes it by itself, there's other players that are involved. But in the end, whatever that comes about, 2 years, whatever down the road, whatever happens with adjudication, the courts will stipulate, and basically you are correct that most users on the Mesa or in the Santa Maria groundwater basin will be stipulated by that court judgment. Normally, individual property owners are not included, but here again, that depends on the judge.
Yeah, not a required meter in the wrong well, so.
that's one method of accomplishing things. But the answer to your question is that when the judgment comes out, it affects all pumpers in the mix. But if the district goes by itself, it would not.
So we could set a moratorium and we just within district boundaries and they run a hose in and feed water from any place they wanted.
That is possible.
Effectively, yeah. Okay. Any other questions on this particular item? It was information only, right? Mr. Seitz? Okay. Public comment on our status of district service capacities?
John Snyder, 562 Eucalyptus Road. A humorous note. As I was thinking about this, I was thinking, my car speedometer, it goes up to 120. And, my car, I think it might even go up to 120. But because there's the speed limit and the stop sign and the stop light, I never calculate on that when I drive over here. So I think you guys are in a similar situation. If you can tell, you guys have got a little oath there of office that says you got to follow the laws, or that you swear you will follow the laws, and I think you need to consider that carefully when you do these calculations. And certainly if you have a paper like this, you ought to make sure it has a disclaimer that says that it has nothing to do with the legal limits, because that's kind of implied that you'll follow the law. So I think you should do that carefully. Thank you.
Can we ask a question? Which law are we breaking?
No.
I feel like I have a fair question, John. Do you know any laws that the district is breaking?
No, I'm not sure. The district know any laws it's breaking?
I know the law, but let me just I think Doug has correctly summarized, and I do have a memo that is in the agenda packet. Regarding the legal obligations of the district to serve water. Mr. President, if I could, I'd go through it quickly, or...
Is this the memorandum?
I didn't go through it at all.
Water code? No. What the, yes.
Okay, well, first of all, the district is a voter-approved district. In other words, the district residents voted to form the district. And we are, as John will tell us over and over again, that we're an appropriator of water here in the state of California, and we'll rely on this groundwater basin. As appropriator and as an elected or voter-approved board, we have an obligation to serve water to those folks that are within our district. That's what why they voted the district in and why they specifically elected individuals to run it. So as long as we have supplies, we have the obligation to serve. Now, when it comes to permitting new services, Doug correctly cited the board to Title 22. That gives the California Administrative Code. And if you look at my memo on page 2, you'll see a section on permitting new water connections. Now, I'm going to read from section 64568 of Title 22. It says a new service connection may be added to the distribution system only if the water system will comply with section 64562. I'll talk about that in a minute. And adding the new connection will not cause pressure reductions as required in section 64566. So there's a two-step process in permitting new connections. One is that you have an adequate quantity of supply. And what it says, adequately, dependably, and safely has sufficient supplies to meet user demand, users of the district under maximum demand conditions before an agreement to permit additional services is allowed. The other one is the pressure requirement, which basically requires the district to maintain 20 pounds per square inch at the meter under maximum hourly demand and under user average J demand plus design flow plus fire flow. And I think that is the stress of the issues. Now, if the district can't do that, I cited a case in my memorandum, Residents for Adequate Water at all versus Redwood Valley, California Water District, where that question was raised, and the court reiterated that those were the conditions that the district or any governmental agency could not meet those, they could not permit new water. Now, the district is and has the power to and must adopt reasonable rules and regulations regarding this water. And I cited those codes, those sections. We are required by ordinance to adopt our rules and regulations regarding water. And we have to make sure, I think that the one constitutional issue that sort of comes up over and over is the equal protection clause of the United States and California Constitution, which basically says that you have to treat people similarly situated, which means you can't pick and choose. This guy gets water, this guy doesn't. You have to treat everybody under your rules and regulations that are substantially the same. I also included in this memorandum a second memorandum. This is, by the way, the first memorandum is an old memorandum that has been republished for the purposes of this agenda. And then, in respect to specific questions of the last meeting, I addressed the issues of Water Code Section 350, and which allows the board, or provides a procedure for the board to make certain findings that they can declare a water shortage emergency, which would allow the board, based on these findings, to enact regulations either restricting or prohibiting new connections to the water system. And just for the audience that we have that memorandum, whenever it finds and determines that the ordinary demands and requirements of a water consumer cannot be satisfied without depleting the water supply and distributing to the extent that there would be insufficient water for human consumption, sanitation, and fire protection. And just to reiterate that Water Code Section 350 also contains Section 358, which has a standard of review, and when the basis is that when the board implements a water shortage emergency and acts regulations, neither the declaration or the restrictions adopted by the board can be fraudulent, arbitrary, or capricious. And that's the standard that the courts would take a look at. And if there was a challenge to any declaration or regulation. But I'd be happy to answer any further questions. Okay. So you gotta go to memorandum number two.
Right, I'm on that.
Okay, if you go to page three, right above where I have end memo, that has the court review, the standards, and
this phrase on page two, the phrase conserve the water supply,
yes,
implies that the district is empowered to maintain appropriate reserves of water to maintain future needs.
Absolutely.
And that it will not run out of water before taking conservation measures. And so how does that fit in with our situation
that would,
here?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not an engineer, so I really cannot.
Yeah, I can inject this. This came about in Marin County when they had the great drought, and 100% of Marin County at that time was surface water supplies, and their reservoirs dropped down sufficiently to the point where their reserves were minimal. And that's basically what it's referring to, surface water supplies and reservoirs.
I may just have a word. What that means is in the context is that when I remember we talked about the group, a group of security decision, if I'm quite sure, briefly mentioned it, was that if you take a look at adopting water shortage regulations, it's kind of a three-step process. One is you have to have a notice public hearing, and this type of notice is publication notice. Before you even get there, you need to have studies to support whatever decision the board may or may not want to recommend. So you need to go through that step, but then you know there's two steps. One is conducting the public hearings, finding if you can, and if those public hearings support a water shortage, you make those findings. Then you can adopt reasonable rules and regulations. And what this court said in the Swanson versus the Marin Municipal Water District is that if you find those water shortages, you don't have to, you don't have to come up to the very shortage itself and then say stop. You can, as Director Wynn has pointed out in the past, you can dock the boat. You know, you can, if you anticipate a water shortage, or the inability to provide services that are provided under Water Code Section 350, you can ease up to that point where you would eventually say you have no more. And that would be part of the rules and regulations that you could adopt, that you're authorized to adopt. Again, all on specific findings to get you there. Hope I answered your question.
How often do you monitor the production and the yield of your wells?
Probably we measure the drawdowns or the water table every quarterly, every 3 months.
How often do you measure the production?
We have meters on them and we record all the productions on a monthly basis.
And the yield and the flow.
Yeah, we're trying to work on a specific yield, which is a drawdown versus production. That kind of gives you an idea of what the well is producing and efficiency of the well.
Any other comments or questions on this item? Okay, seeing none, we'll go on to Administrative Item B2, Request for Service. For water and sewer for an office building at 250 West Dana Street.
Mr. President, we received a request for a water and sewer service for an office building, which is basically across the street. This is a
diagram of the office building. This is Wilson Street, Dana Street. Basically, the district office is just across from this building. The three-building layout. You have two big spaces, and then the labor union's office, which is in the back. This is kind of the front view that will be facing the district offices. They request an intent to serve letter, and staff recommends an intent to serve letter be issued with the items that they enter into a plan check inspection agreement, submit improvement plans, pay appropriate fees, submit the fine, which is reproducible, et cetera, after, and that the intent to serve letter would expire after 2 years. This is our boilerplate. The requirements may, some will apply, some will not apply. So staff did recommend that an intent to serve letter be issued for the proposed project.
Any public comment?
Good morning. My name is Lou Kluver, and I'm the architect representing the labor union. My purview is not water or sewer, but is design. And with the discussion we just had, if there's anything wrong with this design that doesn't allow us the right to have our water, please let me know. I will do whatever it takes to make sure that this happens. I had made the assumption that everything was fine and then realized it wasn't. So please let me know if there's any questions I can answer or anything that we are doing wrong with this development that would preclude us from receiving this. Is there anything?
I just said, but, you know, we don't have any jurisdiction over architectural review or anything else, but I'm just curious, does that have a metal roof?
Yes, it does have a metal roof.
Oh, that's ours.
We try to make it look like this very nice looking building. We have basically four water closets and four labs. It's very low use when it comes down to water and sewer. So if there's any questions from the board, I'd be glad to.
Any questions? I have a motion made. Okay, if no questions, we'll bring back to the board for discussion and or a motion.
I move that we approve the intent to serve letter for the office building across the street with the above-mentioned conditions.
Mr. Wynn made a motion. I'm looking for a second.
Down at that end of the table.
Well, I don't hear any noise down there, but I can second it.
I'll second.
Okay. Mr. Trotter will second the motion. We have a roll call vote, please.
Director Brand.
Yes.
Director Trotter.
Yes.
Director Horstman.
No.
Director Blair.
Yes.
And President LeBron.
Yes.
Can you, what was the vote
now?
How many to one?
Okay, I just think it.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, then, yeah, it's good for another 2 years.
Thank you. Covered that one. Item D3, ordinance to establish a variance procedure. Review the proposed ordinance to establish a variance procedure for the district. Mr. Jones.
Yeah, Mr. President. We have a, at the board meeting previously, there's some discussion about having a variance procedure. The president of the district does not have one, and it's kind of brought to the board by staff if there's real, you know, certain concerns that is beyond staff's procedure. And so legal counsel has put a document together for establishing a variance procedure. We kind of looked at it, and staff-wise, in this process of creating a variance, I think we should go through our codes, and sometimes there's some possible inconsistencies in the code that would need to be addressed to clarify certain items, which would probably be advantageous, therefore eliminating certain variances that may come in because of certain maybe potential conflicts. So the district has no problem with proceeding with the variance, but I would kind of combine it with updating the codes.
I think we have some interested members out there, so I think I should probably, I know Steve's, Mr. Kuhl is here, and is interested, so I thought maybe what we should probably do is go through what the variance policy is, just to make sure that, so that we do have people that are interested out there. And I do have, and what this, currently the district code does not have a variance policy. And we, at the last board meeting, we looked at three variance policies, and the board landed, decided to proceed, and basically landed on this variance policy that is here before you. And the board made a couple of determinations at the last meeting. One is that it would only apply to physical infrastructure, that it would not apply to fees, and two, that there was going to be a process in applying for an appeal, had to be in writing, had to address why the variance was going to be requested, and the application had to discuss why either the size, shape, topography, or location created really great hardship if there was going to be strict compliance with the variance itself. Section 3 of the variance policy says a variance shall not be granted to waive a district rate charge that is directly related to district services. It required a hearing process before the board, and the board would only grant variances because of special circumstances, again, related to size, shape, topography, location, or surroundings, that would create a practical difficulty or hardship, and further that granting the variance would not tend to defeat the purpose of the particular rule or regulation that they were seeking the variance from. The other thing that we included in there, that if you were granted a variance, you need to start construction of the facilities within 180 days, and you had one shot at extending it for additional 180 days if you wanted to come back to the board. And the idea behind that was is that you didn't want to have variances accumulating on variances. If you had one project that had a variance in place, and then another project came along that would impact that variance, then you would be considering, be put in the position of considering a variance within a variance, and I think the board just felt that would be too confusing and too unmanageable to handle. So they did put a time limit as to when the variance was, how long the variance would last before it would revert back to the regular district standards. And I just had one comment, I think, that I would add on applicability, paragraph A. It says the property owner affected by the district's requirement or regulation to construct water and or sewer infrastructure improvements as a condition. I'd search the word infrastructure before the word improvements.
Mr. Sykes, in our last meeting when we were discussing this, Director Trotter brought up an interesting issue, which is simply that it was his understanding, and mine too, that the board always had the residual authority to make discretionary decisions with or without a policy in place. And my question is, by adopting this, do we actually lose those powers in some sense in this area?
The board, let me answer it, direct it this way. I think that the board always has the ability to find exceptions to its rules and regulations in your inherent authority. The problem goes right back to what we discussed on the very first issue. You have to treat similarly situated people similarly, and that's the Equal Protection Clause that's found in both constitutions. And what can happen, I'm not saying it would happen, but what can happen is that if the board got into a position of granting variances or exceptions to its rules and regulations, there would be no record to distinguish it from the next person that came in. And it can create, in my mind, and I've seen it create in my mind, a catch-22 where, you have no real record as to why you granted the variance 2 years ago, and yet you have a person that, on paper, has the exact same situation, and yet you're denying them a variance. So you find yourself in situations where the rule gets so riddled with variances that the rule is no longer the rule. And I think that is a situation that is bad policy to find yourself in. So most jurisdictions, and if you recall that we brought you various policies from other community services districts for you to review that had addressed that very issue, is that when are we going to do it and what type of record do we want so that we can distinguish between a variance that may be granted this year from a variance that's going to be granted 6 months from now when some developer or homeowner comes in and makes the exact same argument. So I think what this does is provides the district with a record, makes certain findings, and ultimately, I think, would give the board more discretion to deny variances into the future than it would be to allow them to continue.
Yeah, it doesn't take the authority from the board. It just sets up a procedure to follow for variance.
This is a matter to me. There's some question about that.
I would say that it is true. But it also is a board aid, because when somebody comes in and applies for a variance, you know, what can it be? Just a little letter, I want a variance, and then staff, you know, and then you need to address that on public testimony, or does the board get a articulated application so that you can see precisely when it comes up for your review and consideration, does it have in there what you want to see? And as a staff aide, I think your point is well taken, because staff would then be in a position to address the issues that are raised in the application so that the board would have a fair presentation on what it is and whether or not staff recommends it, staff doesn't recommend it, and gives you a platform to conduct your debate.
Any public comment? And then bring it back to the board?
Right.
Well, I think Mr. Poole has probably an issue where it says variances will not be given on fees, and none of his issues on a fee issue. You might want to discuss that with the board.
Okay. Did you pass the board?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good morning, board members. My name is Steve Poole. I'm one of the partners in the Fort Locke self-storage project. That's the large project that's going in on Frontage Road on the west side of the freeway. I'm sure you've all seen it. It's in its closing stages. Hopefully, we'll be opening next month. I'm not sure if my comments have to do with the variance procedure that Mr. Seitz discussed with you or not. So let me explain why I'm here, and I'll also explain the handout that I've given you. You don't need to be reading it while I'm speaking. At the time we started our project, and our project included more than just the self-storage, it also included the houses that were across the street from it. It was a larger tract called Tract 2210. For development of future resources and storage capacity, production capacity, and so forth. What happened was, late last year, we got a letter from Mr. Jones pointing out that anything about meters, that based on that meter size and under your ordinance provisions, we had to pay an additional fee of $56,167, and that's the first page of the thing that I've given you, is Mr. Jones' letter to us. That was the first awareness we had that we were going to have that charge. It wasn't in our budget, so it kind of caught us off guard. In looking at it, we took a look at your ordinance, and if you look in the second page of what I gave you, I've highlighted the relevant portion, and that's from section 3.04.140 of your ordinance code. And what that says is that where you have a private fire service, which is what we are, the sprinkler system, that you pay a connection fee or a capacity charge that's 25% of what the charge would be if you were actually getting service through that service or that meter. And so then, and those fees are calculated under Appendix A of your ordinance, and that's the third page of the thing that you have in front of you. And so mathematically, if you look at Mr. Jones's letter, he went through the mathematics, and that was the end result was the 56,000. And we don't have any argument with Mr. Jones' mathematics on that. That appears to be correct. Let me explain what our concern is. As I'm sure you know from earlier discussions about these types of charges, when a public agency adopts these capital improvement charges or capacity fees, whatever name you give them, the government code requires that, first of all, you have to have a factual basis for establishing that. You have to have some kind of a study in front of you that says, we're going to need these facilities and this is what it's going to cost. And that kind of relates back to the report that Mr. Jones was giving you earlier about water and sewer facilities that you're going to need in the future. If you don't have that factual basis, then you're not in compliance with the government code, and you have an additional problem, and that is that if you're charging more than you really need, that extra charge is defined as a special tax, and that violates Proposition 13 and all the stuff that came after that, and you have to go to a vote of the people to get approval of that special tax. So in talking with Mr. Jones about this and asking what the factual basis was for levying this high of a capacity charge on a fire sprinkler system that hopefully will never be used, not a single drop of water will ever flow through that system if we operate our project correctly, he referred me to a report that I guess your district had done in 1996 by a Perry Luke CPA. I don't know if you folks are familiar with that, but that's the report. We've gone through that report very carefully, and Mr. Luke did an excellent job of talking about what your district was going to need in the future, and he talked about costs and so forth. But we can't find anything in his report that talks about what the charge should be for fire sprinkler systems that probably will never be used, but maybe could be used on a one-time basis. There would be water flowing through it, and maybe you need to plan a certain capacity for it. So right now we're kind of in the position where we're thinking, is there a factual basis for levying that high of a charge on us for our fire sprinkler system that hopefully would never be used? So the reason I'm here today is we're not here to negotiate the fee. We're not here to ask for a variance because you don't have a variance procedure. What we want your board to do is take a look at section 3.04.140, where it talks about having to pay a capacity charge for fire sprinkler systems. And we'd like your board to decide, is there a factual basis for that? Is it fair? I mean, is it just fair from the standpoint of the developer who has to pay that charge over and above your usual connection fees for receiving the water service itself? So that's why I'm here. As I say, I don't know if that fits in with this variance because we've already got our facilities built. The meter is already in, as far as I know. The problem is that we can't open up until we've paid the fee. So that's it.
Any questions?
Just a little background. This project came in, and as Mr. Cool mentioned, on the original development plan, it did not show a fire service. So at that time, the fees were not calculated, did not know about the fire service. Then staff in the field found them that they were connecting to the line without authority, and we shut them down because it was an illegal connection, and they were told that they need to pay a fire fee. I believe, and Lisa can go back on Perry Locke's study, he ran through and came up with a fire capacity fee. And in his study, he recommended 50% of the cost, and the board adopted 25%, basically cut his recommendation in half. And basically, that's where it comes from. Even though, as Mr. Cool says, and we concur that hopefully this system is never used or never has to be used, but the district has the responsibility to maintain adequate storage capacity in the line size and production and everything else to maintain the fire protection there, and that costs a whole bunch. And that's basically what the reason that Mr. Locke initially said 50% and the board dropped down to 25% of a normal capacity charge.
Does the incidental water go through the same meter?
No.
Because it's not?
It's a dedicated detector check valve on the service.
Fire protection.
That's correct.
Before we go too far down this path, I think from the variance policy, that's before the board. It's probably B3 that is the issue. If the board was to want to reconsider the ordinance that Mr. Kuhl is referring you to, which is section, I think, 3.04.1403, I think that you can't do under this agenda item. So if there was the board's desire, you know, collectively to want to readdress that issue, then under the Brown Act, you would be allowed by motion, second, and voice vote, with a majority vote, to place this item on your next agenda for further review and consideration.
That's the question I was going to ask, if we could put this on the agenda and discuss just the, basically it's to be a waiver of our rate charge, wouldn't it?
That's correct. And under the variance policy, see, this is an ordinance right here, what we're looking at. But again, this ordinance would require, you know, an introduction, second reading, and 30 days for passage. If the board were to ultimately agree with Mr. Kuhl's position, and I'm not forecasting that you should or you shouldn't, again, it would require an ordinance modification to that ordinance in order to grant the variance. Staff would be hard to recommend, especially on a capacity charge issue, that you would grant exceptions unless you had a clear variance policy for that, because what happens with capacity fees ultimately is somebody pays for it. Capacity fees, by their nature, the district is required to accumulate, you know, to build infrastructure for that capacity. So it's not a question of whether or not we will build that capacity or reserve that capacity for this project. The ultimate question is who pays for that capacity. And that's basically why, in my number of years, staff I can't remember a situation where we where a capacity charge was justified other than through the ordinance amendment process itself. In other words, the ordinance was unreasonable, as Mr. Kuhl makes his argument for it.
My understanding that Mr. Kuhl is not asking for a variance on the fee. He's simply questioning the grounds on which we calculate such a high fee.
I don't want to put words in Steve's mouth, but
I don't think there's anything to fear from looking at ordinances as people ask us to from time to time. And I would request that we do bring that back to the board, reconsider the ordinance, the factual grounds for the ordinance, and whether it's just and fair and so forth. But I don't think that has anything to do with this item on the agenda, and I appreciate that Mr. Kuhl was asked to wait until this time, but I would like to bring it back and talk about it, and I don't have any, I just like to see the findings and take it from there. Do we actually have to have a first and a second on that, or can any director ask for an item to be placed on the agenda?
We'll put it on the agenda.
Okay, I asked her. I do want to comment on this item, D3, and specifically section 2, part B, part 3, which is a variance shall not be granted to waive the district rate or charge that is directly related to district services. This has to do with a variance on fees and not what Mr. Kuhl is talking about. Just to understand this carefully, I'm looking at two requests that are being made to our board in various stages of of articulation, by public agencies asking for variances on fees. One, of course, is which the, is the park over here, who would like to have water at a cheap rate. And another is the new high school, which through sort of a comedy of errors on both sides, ends up owing $92,000 more than what anybody knew they owed. If I also look up to see if there's any member from the press is here. And if I understood the standard that you were talking to Mr. Seitz, in order to have equal protection, if we said yes to the high school and no to the park, we would have to have some finding that specifically said that even though they're both public agencies and they both serve the same target audience, that somehow there's a meaningful difference between the two if we were going to say yes to one and no to the other. Is that correct?
That's my opinion.
Yeah.
Well, unless you can make, unless you could make, you could distinguish somehow between the two.
Yes.
We could take a look at talking about a variance related to fees and charges. Now, and this is a good question. If we were to move forward with this policy, we could rule it, put in there, unless it is an agency or, and this is the typical questions you get into. And it seems to me that there are basically three types of applications for variances. If I were to talk about fees only, okay? First of all, there would be what you might call private development. And let's just say for a profit. And I'm not trying to say that, and again, I would include in there commercial, residential, but just self-motivated, something where somebody's fucking directly benefit. The second type is probably what you run into is possibly a nonprofit corporation that would have an area-wide benefit to the district somehow. Then the third one would be another governmental agency, again, that is not working on a profit motive, but would provide an area-wide benefit, or district-wide benefit, I should probably say, but an area-wide.
You get your question there?
How you want that addressed, of course, is for the board. That's the policy.
The only specific question I have on this is that if we pass this ordinance today with this statement saying it shall not be granted, do we lose then the discretionary power to discuss this publicly and come to some other findings?
Go ahead.
Procedure-wise, this is just reviewing it. It'll have to have the first reading and second reading, so it'll have to be brought back to the board in an ordinance form. So this is not presented for first reading.
First reading today?
No, it's for discussion purposes.
Okay.
Exactly what we're doing.
Okay. Okay.
So, it can be modified, and then once it's all modified, and then brought back for the first reading introduction.
Then I think maybe I understand as much as I need to today.
Well, I would like to have that clarified. Say we adopted this today, would that apply?
What Director Wynn brings up is an excellent point. And the answer to that, under our policies, there would be no exceptions for rates and charges. So one of the reasons why the board brought this back is that a policy that the board wants. Now, if you don't want that, you can give us some direction, and we bring it back at the next meeting. We can add some language that hopefully we can tailor to what the board's view on variances as it relates to rates or charges.
Well, I certainly do not intend to have staff hounded by long lines of people, each of whom have some argument for why they should pay less than everybody else. And I do understand that eventually somebody has to pay. And so to pass the cost on to others is not my intention at all. I wonder...
The question comes up, as written, can a government agency come in and prepare for relief from water rates based on their application?
Yes. If we adopted this language...
The answer to that would be no.
That's right. Then I'm going to have to stew on it some more.
You'd have to go back and amend the ordinance.
Then I'm going to have to kind of work on it a little bit in my own head just to get my own thinking.
I'll do this a direct answer. I don't have a recollection. The only time that the board has reduced capacity charges, because remember, when we talk about capacity charges, Doug, correct me if I'm wrong here, is when they brought in their own water supply. So that we've had it wasn't a rate or fee, because the capacity charge itself, when you enact a capacity charge, they're buying into your infrastructure, your water wells, your tanks, and your other things that a board has, you know, on certain projects said, okay, because you built the well, it would be unfair for us to charge that capacity charge for that well because you brought it on as a condition to development.
Actually,
that's a little different story than it
is. I'm not really focused on capacity charges
okay.
at the moment at all. And I'm not really still thinking about Mr. Kuhl's proposal.
Yeah.
That's not my issue at all. I'm curious whether this might be modified to say a variance shall not be granted to waive the district rate or charge as directly related to district services unless there are findings that demonstrate a district-wide benefit. Then that would open the door for some kinds of applicants, which I know it would make your life more difficult, right?
Well, I can see Papa Pizza's coming in and say, hey, I'm a district-wide benefit. I can feed everybody in the community.
I know that every time you open up the door a little bit, you create opportunities for all sorts of mischief, and I apologize. But I hesitate to give away our capacity to respond to some kinds of situations.
Well, if a situation does arise, which would be extremely rare, the board could say, okay, based on this situation, now you have a definite situation, you can modify it to meet that situation, which would only take, you know, a month or two to process. You can go back and amend the ordinance. No fees right now, but you have a special circumstance comes in, which I don't know of right offhand, that requests some modification. We don't allow that, but the board can say, we'll put it back on the agenda, we'll look at that thing, we'll come back and modify it, reword it to apply to that particular situation. That's an option also. Instead of incorporating now without knowing what the others.
The results
are
the same if you came to the board without a variance policy.
It's a procedural aspect.
Well, I mentioned that at the last meeting. I don't see any great value in this other than the guide for the manager. Because any significant issue will come to the board anyway.
Then as a variation on what Mr. Trotter is suggesting, if we omitted item 3, we simply had no language that discussed rates, would that attract a horde of eager applicants, or would that simply leave the door open without having to amend the ordinance?
Leave the door open, I think.
See, this is a policy issue for the board, so I'm not trying to dissuade you or persuade you one way or the other.
Yeah.
It is just that, you know, the real question is if the board, wants to establish a variance policy, and that goes to what Cliff has been talking about, is one issue. But if you're going to establish the variance policy, does the board want to have the authority to review rates on an ad hoc basis? And when you really circle the wagons, I'm not saying ad hoc's a bad word, but I'm trying to point out to you is on certain situations. And that, I think that's the debate. Does the board want to have that ability? Because now you have some real competing interests, because the water is going to be paid for, or the sewer is going to be paid for, regardless of whether the applicant pays for it or not. Somebody else is actually going to pay for it. And if that's a way the board wants to go, I'll tell you what we could do is we could bring back several variations of Section B3, and at the next hearing on this matter, and you could take a look at it, see if we can staff and put something together that would make some sense for you.
Now, all the fees have to be established and warranted, as Mr. Kuhl said, and basically they are. Before we establish fees, we have studies done to vary from those fees, and I'm not sure if you have another study to justify the variance.
And you know, we're not a for-profit business. I mean, I know that every expense out there, we're actually spending on real costs. So
to expect things like legal counsel said, we can bring some of our verbiage back and another look at it before having the first reading, if the board wants to go for it at that time.
Can you tell us about
it? Yeah. This is just capacity or all fees?
Well, that's the question.
I'm not saying capacity.
Okay.
I'm just saying
B3. I've got a conflict, but I'd like to address it from over there. Can I do that on the fees?
No, in theory?
Yeah. Because on a variance, and I'm not sure, because what Kuhl said about equal protection. See, let me do it from over there. And you can see whether this jumps in or not.
Mr. Blair has excused himself to be present in public at this moment.
I just did a project. I'm in the process of doing a house. I dealt with four public agencies for service. The gas company, the water company, the electric company, and the telephone company. All those people had rates for putting in their service. The water company has a flat rate for putting in a water meter, $700 or whatever it is, $760. If I do part of the work, because I had equipment out there, I dug the hole. I dug the hole for the water line. I exposed the water main. I found the water main. I cleaned out around the water main. After they put the water service in, I used my tractor, filled in the hole. I got charged the same $700. Now, with the electric company said to me, if you dig the hole, we will give you credit for digging the hole. The telephone company said, if you dig the hole, we will give you credit for digging the hole. And the gas company said, there is this rate for putting in the gas service to your house, or if we dig the hole, there is that rate. The gas company charged me less to put in a gas meter 860 feet from the street and dug up the street than the water company charged me to put in a water service from here to the end of the sidewalk without digging up anything. So I think this needs to be addressed, because we're the only agency that doesn't address this. All contractors. All contractors have equipment out there. If they have equipment out there and can provide the service, they should be credited with it. If it costs the districts more money, then the district should be able to acquire more money too. In other words, if the flat fee, $700, doesn't acquire the flat fee, then we should have some way of charging more too, because Doug said one project cost $14,000 for the installation, so the district didn't do it. We're not very flexible. And I mean, I've heard comments from other contractors before I got to this situation. It's only when your own ox is gored that you pay attention. But we need to look at that.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes,
yeah.
What would Cal Cities get charged
for? I don't know, because I'm not looking for a meter at Cal Cities. If I was digging up for Cal Cities, I think Cal Cities, you can do the construction yourself. I mean, I paid a backhoe was $75 an hour, plus I had my own piece of equipment out there, which is, you know, I worked right with the people putting it in. I handed them the tools and did whatever and filled the ditch in after they left. So
That's what I'm saying. There should be some flexibility in there for the contractor if he's doing the work. Because if you got the equipment out there, why not? I mean, it's cheaper for the district. They would have had to run a backhoe out there anyway.
Mr. President, these are one of the things in the ordinance, you know, we're looking at of revising, and we'll probably revise that we will not put in any services because the fees vary so much, so we'll probably just take that off in the future.
And I won't vote on that. Okay? I mean, you know, because it's a conflict.
Well, I'm sure Mr. Blair got off the public podium and back behind the desk again. Thank you, Bob.
Okay.
Okay, well, the board wants to bring back revisions and the fee situation in that one paragraph. The board can take another look at it or make a final determination if you want to go forward with this or not. We'll bring it back to the next meeting, and then based on direction of the board, then we can proceed with the first and second readings.
Sounds good to me, because to me a variance should cover fees, if possible, plus work. Because no variance is a variance. I mean, you can't.
Okay.
If
any of the board members have any verbiage, we'd appreciate it, and then along with legal staff, we'll work up something.
Any other questions? Any public comments on this particular one? Should ask for that first. You get to listen to everybody.
Okay. I'm John Effort. Live in the Pomo, 1505 Champions Lane. It would seem to me that when you put fire sprinklers in a building, it's a service to the whole community. If the place catches fire and they have sprinklers, it keeps the place next door burning down or starting a forest fire or whatever. And I feel that NCSD, in their infrastructure, should build storage and pipelines or whatever it is large enough to take care of buildings that put in fire protection equipment. And being it's a service to everybody, why should one outfit have to pay extra for this service?
Well, you know,
we should encourage people to put in. This building here should have fire extinguishers. There's a lot of public use of this building, and if a fire was to break out, we should have it protected, just like the high school or city hall or anything else.
Yeah, well, like legal counsel mentioned, if that's the case, it still has to be paid for. Black Lake's going to, you know, pick up another 10 or 20 bucks per month per user, then we could do something like that. It has to be paid for.
And I think that's exactly the reason the speaker brings up a good point. And I think, you know, we have to reserve capacity in our system, in our tanks, and our well capacity in case the chance that that place catches on fire. And what will happen is that our tanks will drain down quicker in the event because all these sprinklers on a 6-inch meter. How much water goes through that?
A couple thousand gallons.
A couple thousand gallons per minute. Pretty big hit on the system. And if you're a typical resident, when you connect your stuff, you back buy that capacity to serve that piece of property. You buy, you actually kind of, you look at it in the books, you would say, you know, you got this capacity in this tank, this capacity in this well, this capacity in these water lines to provide you service. That's what capacity charges go for. Same thing applies for fire. You know, that if the developer has the expectation, and more importantly, CDF has the expectation, that if a fire occurs, it's going to take, and it, but really, CDF makes these calculations, not the district. It's going to require this amount of water to put that fire out. That's when they come up with their meter sizes for their sprinklers. The district has to reserve that capacity in that system in order to address that fire that CDF is concerned about. And instead of charging a fire capacity fee for the total projected need, which would be 100% of a 6-inch meter, Perry Locke's study recommended one half of the capacity fees to run the, you know, store the water to run through that meter. The board back in 1996 took a look at, and I think through the public comment process, determined that even one half was too much money to require. So they actually knocked it down another half and came up with 25%. So, I just want to make sure the speaker makes a good point. I just want him to know that the board was not unsympathetic to that when they enacted the ordinance in the first place, that it was a costly requirement. But I also want everybody to understand why you charge for those capacity issues, because somebody's capacity is going to be in that tank, one way or the other.
The interesting thing is, of course, we live in a town in which the theoretical possibility became real. I mean, 120 years ago, this entire town burned down to the ground, leaving only about four or five buildings standing. I mean, the ground that we're on, everything you can see out the windows all burned down at that time. So we say, well, we'll never need it, we'll never be water for it, and so forth, but fires do occur, and we have to have capacity to serve those when we need it.
We are done with the variance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. President, may I suggest going to item D4?
I'm going to apologize. I should have read this because I looked at Mr. Martin. D4, we could have brought him in before we had this long discussion. So we go to item D4, which is mandatory garbage service.
Yeah, Mr. President, we received some correspondence from the garbage company about fees with respect to mandatory service versus volunteer service. You have an overhead showing the differences in the fee structure. We want direction from the board if they wish to proceed with mandatory versus volunteer, and Mr. Martin here to explain the garbage company's operations for any of the board's questions that you may have. And I just made a point out, basically on the voluntary rate, they're looking at maybe 14%, so the new rate would be these numbers here. If you go with mandatory, you're looking at roughly a 5% rate increase and the numbers variance of the two.
There's an excellent article in the paper this morning regarding this. What is one of the covers all the bases.
Yeah. Yeah, Stephanie talked to me for a while on that.
What's on garbage? Mr. Martin, present.
I can say something, I had a plan on it. Basically, in looking at the top two tiers on the letter, the county has adopted a policy.
You have to state your name and
Tom Martin, I'm the controller for Napomo Garbage, which is associated with South County.
Thank you.
Just so you know, the NCSD boundary line does not include the area of Napomo, right, what we call the bluff, from division leftward, basically. And so the county has adopted a position of trying to lower the one-can rate to encourage people to go to the one-can rate and make the two-can rate and the three-can rates higher. And that's, in their mind, encourages recycling. There is that tax that you can take, or there is just the straight across-the-board tax and raise everybody's rates the same percentage. If you do go to the mandatory, you have the same option if you decide to go with mandatory, in terms of you can just go flat across the board, or you can try and make the one can rate a little bit lower and make the other rates higher. That really is just a policy position that the board has to take, and you can do whichever way you want. And other than that, I'm here to answer your questions if you have any.
What's the status of the buyout right now?
The lawyers are still butting heads, and they're in the process of doing all that. The staff report from the consultant that the IWMA hired is out. They had a meeting yesterday, I believe, with all the city staff people and municipality staff people that wanted to go to it. And then Thursday, there is Waste Connections will be in town to answer any questions anybody has. And then we envision moving forward probably within the next 30 days to try and get that all signed, sealed, and delivered.
The rate increase that's going to affect Napomo or the area that we are encompassing, about how much is that total? Do you have any idea, like the dollar amount, like say it's a dollar a can for X number of residents, or it goes up $1.15, how much about
If you're not looking at mandatory, it's 14% of the rate. So you're talking 14% on 1150. $1.75, $1.65.
Times how many customers?
I have the...
4,000 customers?
No, I only have 2,700 residents.
What I'm getting at is the district is going to take over garbage instead of the county.
Correct.
So we are going to get a certain amount of money rebated because Michael's been asking people what to do with this money, right?
Right.
Why not apply part of it to the rate increase and just solve the problem? Because that's what we did with lighting and other things. Then we wouldn't have to go to mandatory garbage. We could just, if it's only $8,000.
Now, are we talking about in terms of adjusting the franchise fees? Is that what you're...
Well, yeah, because the district is going to realize a certain amount in addition.
The district generates about 67,000 right now. After the rate increase without mandatory, you'll generate about 77,000.
So what I'm saying is there's only a few thousand dollars difference on the rate increase. We could just absorb the rate increase and we still would generate an additional amount of money.
The rate increase will generate, if you, the 14.9% across the board rate increase will generate $95,000 in additional revenue to me to cover expenses. You currently take in $67,000 in franchise fee. Now, if you want to offset some of that $95,000 and lower the rate increase, that certainly is within the purview of the board. You can do whatever you wish.
That's what I'm saying. In other words, when we took over lighting in Blacklake, we didn't raise the rate. In fact, the rates remained the same for X number of years, which is considerable. And one of the things that I touted when we were taking over garbage was that we could do it cheaper and better than the county. And I assumed that that's what we were going to do. And if we raise the rate through mandatory garbage or anything else, we're not really doing what I said, and I don't really like that.
You have to keep in mind that the two issues really are separate. This rate increase was submitted over 14 months ago, so it really doesn't have anything to do with the district taking over. Had the county acted in a timely manner, the county would have done this, and you wouldn't be even looking at this. However, they didn't, and now the sad fact is that you guys have to address it.
I understand that, but from a public relations review, I know that the voters and the people out there, they get a rate increase and they're going to say, darn, those guys just took over the garbage and the rate went up. And
that will be the public perception, yeah.
That will be the public perception. And if we've got this extra money, at least for the first honeymoon period, we can absorb part of it out of that extra money. And
I can tell you, though, that what happens is whether it's a 14% increase or whether it's a nickel a month increase, it is still perceived as an increase.
Right.
And if you could buy all of the increase away and do away with it, then certainly I think that'd be a wonderful idea because we don't like raising rates any more than anybody else does. But the fact remains is that unless the district goes negative on their franchise fee, you will not be able to buy down
the
entire
increase. Well, that's what I'm asking. So there's not enough money in the extra.
There is not enough money in the pot to buy it down to zero.
Okay, that's what I was asking.
It seems to me that we're talking about three different issues here, though. One, we're talking about franchise fees, which do not have to do with mandatory service or not. Secondly, we're talking about whether the service should be mandatory. And third, we're talking about whether the rates are going to go up and how much.
And actually, there's one more little twist to it. It's the one that Tom brought up, is what Tom's proposal here is across the board proposal for each service level, and the board, if it wants to, could also debate the issue of what the county did, and that is debate whether or not you would want to lower the increase for the one can rate and make up the difference on the two can or the three can rate with the idea of directing, with AB 939, you're trying to coax, I'm using the wrong word here, folks into the one can rate, which is more AB 939 source reduction compliant, thereby requiring them to, hopefully coaxing them to use the recycle bins more than what they are using, so that the total waste volume comes, Tom, if I get this off, you just let me know. So the total waste volume stays consistent, but that you're switching the tin cans from the solid waste containers into the recycling. You're giving an economic interest in having those folks do that. Now, I don't want to prejudge what the board wants to do, but I can tell you what other districts have done, because I've gone through this. This is my fourth one in the last year. Boards have directed Tom to come back with the following types of scenarios. One is give us the cross-the-board scenario with no mandatory garbage and with mandatory garbage. And that's what he has right here, I think. Second one is give us a scenario where we only increase the one-can rate, by, I'm going to give you a number, I'm not telling you it's a good number, 6%, and then spread the rest of those across the two-can and the three-can rate so that you can take a look at what the different rates are. And the other one that people, other agencies have said, do the whole, those two things all over again, but show what happens at a 7.5% franchise fee. You know, so that you can take a look at three or four different scenarios. The board can then land on one, hopefully. Los Osos went through four hearings on landing on one, so Tom knows it's not always a simple thing. To land on one that you think is most custom for your district, and if he ends up saying the best one is mandatory garbage collection because you spread your fixed costs, lowers the rates for everybody, just what the newspaper article said, Cliff, addresses a lot of side issues, then that would give staff the ability to draft the ordinances to implement the board's policy. You may want to do an ad hoc committee. That's a very other popular procedure to direct the ad hoc committee to review the four things and come back with a recommendation to the board.
To further complicate the issue, I just need to add one thing, and that's that if you don't go mandatory, it becomes harder to predict participation. That if you start playing with the variability of the rates in terms of making the one-can rate cheaper to try and encourage people to go down that way, if you're in a non-mandatory situation, people can opt out of the system and just stop doing it. And so that's always one of the kind of the downsides of not, if you're not going to go to mandatory service, I would not advise you to play with the variability of the rates.
I'll say the district is not mandatory right now.
Nope.
Really. How about green waste? Is that pretty prevalent throughout the Bluffs area? Because I've heard comments that some places don't get green waste pickup yet.
We offer green waste pickup in what we used to consider the Napomo proper, which is the Bluff area, and then on this side of the freeway, pretty much the CSD boundary, and we cut off before you get to Black Lake. Ten Oaks, or I think it's a cutoff in Pomeroy, is up that neck of the woods.
Does this rate include all three cans?
Yes.
Okay.
It includes greenway service. You use your own cans for greenway service. It includes recycling, and you use an orange bin. And then we provide you with a waste wheeler for garbage. If you want a blue waste wheeler or a green waste wheeler, we make those available if you want to rent those.
So when you refer to green waste, where's the store? We put out green waste, and they won't pick it up.
Where do you live?
Oh,
over on
Olympic Way.
Yeah, Olympic. They should.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, that brings up another question. Is one of the things that the board might want to consider, and again, I'm just bringing up my experience of dealing with three other districts that just went through this, and one that's struggling through it right now, and that's Templeton, is whether or not the board wants to require waste wheelers for both green waste and recyclables. And I thought that they were mandated that you had waste wheelers here, but you don't, just for the one service. The debate, I'll just give you a preview of what the debate has been. So the debate has been is that if you use, people do not like taking those yellow cartons out to the sidewalk. Some do, some don't, but there's an X amount of people that don't. The other thing that has come up in this debate is that if you use the carton to go out there, it's too small for the AB 939, you know, target reductions.
You mean the orange one?
The orange one. I'm assuming, I think it's
the orange. Yeah.
The orange one.
We have three of them.
Yeah. So, what most agencies have, as far as I know, I'm trying to think, Los Osos, Templeton, Oceano, San Luis, they have mandatory waste wheelers for all.